You can tell them in the country, tell them in the town. The miners down in Mingo laid their shovels down. We won't pull another pillow, load another ton, or lift another finger till the union we have won. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. There's fire in our hearts and fire in our soul, but there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole.
Welcome to the Workers of the New River Valley, a show where we interview local working class folks and hear about their thoughts, ideas, and issues in our community. I'm your host, Adam Ryan. Today we are joined by fellow worker Nathan. Nathan, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Just wanted to start some questions to get a better sense of knowing who you are, you know, and what upbringing was like. Were you born in this area?
Yeah, born in Radford.
And so you grew up in Radford?
Grew up all over the place around here. Giles, Radford, Christiansburg, Pulaski.
So you've been living in the New River Valley like your whole life?
Yeah.
You know, do you have any family?
Yeah. Brothers and sisters live around here, and my mom's still with us.
Are you married?
Yes.
Have any kids?
Got two boys, and I got a daughter.
So where are you working these days?
Well, right now I'm unemployed.
Okay. What was the last job you worked?
I was working at a tobacco shop.
A tobacco shop?
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was all right. Greatest run in the world, but it was something.
What was the pay like?
A little better than average around here, I guess.
Yeah, was it paying the bills?
Yeah, it was helping.
Do you feel like that's common kind of arrangement of the jobs around here, the job market? How would you rate it?
The job market around here is just either work in a restaurant or you work in a factory, unless you can build a house or, you know, earn some sort of trade.
What do you think is like the quality of those jobs that folks are working around here?
Well, just depends on where you work. I mean, you work in a restaurant, you've got to deal with a lot of, you know, rigmarole and guff of, well, we need you to work this time. Well, you know, I can't work this time. And people just look at you like, well, you just don't want to work. Well, no, I have a life outside of my job. And a lot of employers around here in this area don't care if you have a life outside the job.
Do you think it's a common thing for these jobs to not have benefits or health care or any of that, like, offered to workers? Or if they do, is it not a very good plan?
Some of the benefits are okay, but then some of them, they just, you know, they do the bare minimum to cover what the government requires them to do now.
Yeah, I mean, like my job, you know, they just want to keep everybody part-time status so they don't have to pay them benefits. It's just a cost-saving measure for them.
Yeah, and that's just about any job. They don't want you to work over 40. And they don't want you to work over, well, actually, they don't want you to work over 30 because, you know, they got to pay you something.
Yeah, I know a lot of folks who are working multiple jobs like that, that are part-time, because those jobs just don't want to give them a full-time position. So they have to work multiple part-time positions, and they're not getting any benefits, even though they're working maybe full-time hours or even more than full-time hours.
Yeah, and then, you know, you're stuck. You can't really work what you want to work. To work a day here at this place, and then maybe 2 days over here at this place, and 3 days over here at this place, and then pay out all these taxes and stuff. And I worked 60 hours this week, but I didn't work 60 hours at one place.
Say you were working like 60 hours. Do you feel like you have anything to show for it in the end, or?
With the way cost of living's going up, no.
Speaking of, you know, is that cost of living, or what expenses are you seeing go up? Rent, or?
Yeah, rent goes up the first year. It does. When they find out what your cost of living increase is, they always take half of it.
So you think that's standard around here from landlord?
I don't think it's standard for all landlords. I think it's just for certain ones that's gotten away with it for the longest time.
Who you rent from?
I rent from Radford Company.
Okay, and so do they ever give any reason for why they're increasing the rent?
Well, the reason is that they want to do more for where we stay and make upgrades and stuff. And I haven't seen any upgrades in the last 5 years we've lived here.
And
but the lot rent has went up every 5 years.
So they're increasing the rent, but you're not seeing any like improvements in the services or anything.
No.
I mean, what's it like living in that part?
It's quiet. It's kind of leery too, because you have people living in trailers with no electric. All you see is cars come in and out and people leave in and out, different people all the time. You know, it makes you leery that it's like a stopover point for somebody to go somewhere else.
So you think there's like shady activity going on?
Yeah, there's a lot of shady activity.
Do you think that's kind of standard across the trailer parks in this area? Do you think is it just confined to the trailer parks, or do you think it's also in the apartments or everywhere?
I'd say it's probably everywhere around here. When you see somebody move into a place and there's six vehicles sitting in the driveway and all six of them have different state tags, it makes you kind of wonder.
What's going on?
Yeah, because you don't really, and then you get leery like, okay, do I need to sleep with something under my pillow at nighttime in case somebody decides to break into my home?
I've noticed, you know, walking through, door knocking folks in the parks around here, there's a lot of signs warning folks that, you know, tenants are armed in their units. So I think it kind of reflects, there is a concern, I think, by renters, almost a vulnerability, feeling vulnerable in where folks are living.
Yeah, it's a definite vulnerability because you don't know who's going to knock on your front door.
So your costs of living are increasing, yet that's what you're having to deal with as you're paying more to live at this place.
Yeah.
That's kind of the climate you have to live. Even though it's quiet, it still sounds like there's just not a lot of trust or a sense of community in these parks.
Yeah, there's not really anymore. It used to be, when we were growing up, we lived in a trailer park. You go down the street and play with the neighbor's kids, and they come to your house and play, and you go to their house and eat, and backwards and forwards, you know. It was a community. Now it's more like nobody goes to anybody's place.
Yeah, everybody just keeps to themselves.
They keep to themselves, you know. Neighbor sitting in his driveway and his car's broke down, you go over and help him. Well, now your car breaks down in your driveway, your neighbor looks at you, sorry for you. You know, people's changed from the way we were raised.
So you feel like you've noticed that change from when you first grew up here to where things are at now?
Yeah.
So the sense of community is dissolved?
Yeah, I mean, this community is not what it used to be. You know, communities pull together when things go bad.
Do you think there's any correlation between the quality of jobs around here, the cost of living, and that lack of a community?
It's trending that way. Because the jobs aren't, you know, back when I was growing up here, there was a lot of jobs. There was the arsenal, and, you know, Corning was manufacturing wide open, which Corning's manufacturing still, but there's a lot of jobs that's closed. Pulaski Furniture's gone. I mean, between the furniture plants leaving, Volvo working and then laying off, working and laying off, you know, there's very few industries left around here that you can make a good pay at.
Yeah, like you were saying, it just seems like a lot of the jobs are just the service-based jobs, maybe around the universities, the colleges around here.
Yeah, and then when you can get in the door somewhere, it takes forever.
You know, like we said earlier, in the trailer park where you're at, like, folks feel maybe a little vulnerable, but it seems even on the job, you know, if someone does have a job, they're still feeling vulnerable with that job. It just seems like there's an overwhelming sense of vulnerability behind all this, and which would make sense, too. You know, if there's a less of a community, folks are going to feel more vulnerable because they're going to have less support. That does correspond with what, you know, we're seeing on a national trend, and these developments are happening across the country, you know, for the last several decades. You know, those good jobs leaving the country, or, you know, shrinking the workforce and more automation. Yeah, there's this book I'm reading right now, The Mountains on the Market, which is all about the origins of the New River Valley and you know, from being the early settlements all the way up to presently. But you know, it's interesting just seeing how much this area was just kind of used for extractive industries, you know, which, I mean, makes sense. We're in Appalachia, and this is part of Appalachia, and like all the early kind of operations here were around mining for iron or zinc or lead, and then all the further industries in the area kind of were built around those core extractive industries, which eventually did lead to like the timber and some chemical processing and the furniture stores and all that stuff. What we have is, it's more refined than that, but also we're like detached from those extractive industries in a lot of ways, and we're also left with a huge environmental footprint from all that stuff too, in terms of just toxifying our area. And I mean, the EPA, it only came about in the 70s, you know, it's not that long ago that there was any effort to really bring about, you know, some regulation to not toxify our communities. But it's, you know, we're still dealing with that,
and it's happened, you know, a lot of places around here.
Yeah, there's more than I realized. You know, I was started to do after reading through this book, I started doing more research on, you know, what sites are listed in this area on the EPA website. And there's a lot there's been a lot of incidences in the New River Valley I wasn't even aware of. A lot of folks have been focused on the arsenal in recent years, and I think that's fair. I went to Bellevue growing up, which is the school in that kind of danger zone for when they're incinerating the waste generated at the ammunition site there. And I have, you know, respiratory issues since I was a kid, and, you know, I'm always wondering, is it from exposure to some substances that the arsenal was just throwing up into the air? And I don't know, it's just interesting. It seems like all these good jobs, they're better than what we have now, but then they also had their own costs with them that negatively affected workers in terms of, like, exposure to toxic substances. And it just, I don't know, it just seems like, can we not have an arrangement where we get what we need and also are safe and comfortable, you know?
Yeah, a lot of businesses around here, you know, they take safety first, but when it comes down to it, they need something done. They're not too worried about your safety. Let's get it done.
Yeah, in the end, like, they'll pay lip service to that concept, but then in the end of the day, yeah, they're just about making the money. You know, I think there's some folks out there who probably would say, well, you can have both. You can have folks make their money and still be safe. But in my experience, it's, you know, there are two interests at play when we're at work. Like, there's the interests of workers, which is, you know, we need stability, we need safety. And then there's the interest of our bosses. And it's like they want the greatest productivity, the fastest production. And, like, those two things are at odds with one another, you know. And that's why we have speed ups all the time on our jobs. And that happens across any industry, where they always try to find ways to work you harder and measure you more and scrutinize you more to make you perform better and make you feel like you're going to lose your job if you don't all the time.
So they can make their bonus at the end of the year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my job, I know they actually get bonuses if they go under the payroll that's allocated to them by corporate. So it's like they're literally benefiting financially by giving us less hours through our, like, financial loss, you know, that loss of our ability to form financial stability, you know. And it's just, I don't think folks should have to be pitted against one another like that.
Yeah, and that's usually what they do. They pit people against each other at their jobs, and, you know, that, you know, that's where you lose your sense of community. Because Bob, my next door neighbor over here, me and him worked the same spot, but, well, he stabbed me in the back last week. Now my hours have been cut, and that's what happens.
No, it's a classic tactic many people in power have used, the whole divide and conquer thing, you know. And it's a way to ensure control. And unfortunately, I think it does have, like you're saying, it has a negative effect in terms of destroying a sense of community and support amongst working class folks around here. And we're just kind of in this situation where everybody's just kind of keeps their head down and keeps to themselves and doesn't speak out. I went to California for the first time last year. And it really is kind of like going to a different country. Like, folks are just, I was just kind of astonished at how much folks are willing to just be, you know, outspoken and be heard and talk back, even to authority figures. And, like, growing up in the South and around here, it's just people just keep their heads down and don't speak out. And I mean, I get it. Like, historically, the South has been very violent towards people when they try to speak out, whether it was, you know, black slaves or poor white sharecroppers or mine workers. Anytime, you know, folks who are poor have tried to, you know, push back against, they get violence thrown at them.
Yeah, well, and there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. And, you know, my father worked for one of the mine companies in Giles. This was a long time ago. I was a child. I might have been 9 or 10, and I remember this because they were upset because, you know, minimum wage back then wasn't but like $2.85 an hour. And they were working for a little bit better minimum wage. I think it was like $3.50 or $4, something like that. And, well, the mine down the street got a raise. And they were an affiliate with the mine that my dad worked for, and they didn't get a raise. And they went on a strike. And they didn't have a union.
Oh, wow.
My dad says, you know, I don't think I'll ever do that again. And he didn't. He didn't go back to work for the mines or anything. When you get shot at for your beliefs and thinking that, you know, you should get a fair wage for a fair day's work, and you get shot at for it, you know, it's useless. And that was the way it was back 35, 40 years ago.
I think a lot of times when folks think about labor struggles, they think, you know, someone will have a picket and they're orderly and they're on the sidewalk. But, you know, if you look at any little bit of labor history in this country, even recently, it's just so much violence and bloodshed all throughout it, and not by the workers, but by the bosses and the, like, security companies they'll hire, you know, the private detective company, the Pinkertons, you know, who were founded, and one of the founders is based out of Roanoke. They're famous. They're famous for being the originators of attacking workers when they try to strike for better conditions. You know, that's really interesting. I didn't even know that there was necessarily mining operations in Giles, or that workers were organized. I was going to ask if there was a union,
Limestone mines in Giles. So, and Granddaddy worked at them, retired from them, passed away, you know. Things have changed so much in this area, you know. Employees can't, you know, sit back and say, hey, look, this isn't right what you're doing. Well, if you don't like it, we're going to fire you. Well, there you are. You're scared. You can't really say nothing.
Yeah, you were saying that your dad had gone on strike with other workers over, you know, trying to get better pay, because the other mines owned by the same company were getting pay increases. And so they went on strike, and you said that they got shot at?
Yeah.
Yeah, by the...
That was common practice back in the 70s.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen the documentary, Harlan County, USA.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, as they're shooting that film, I mean, one of the miners even got killed by the
company.
Yeah, by the company.
I'm pretty sure that there was a lot of miners around here that went down there to support those.
And then there was the Pittston mine strike in 89. That was like the last big one that I can remember in this region. And that seems a little more tame, but I know there was definitely some skirmishes going on between the mine workers there and UMWA, I mean, and Pittston Mine Company. And they had, what they called, caltraps, the metal spikes they were like throwing on the ground to flatten the tires so they couldn't get the coal out of the off the mine sites. But I know, you know, when these strikes happen, man, it can get ugly. That's been the history of workers organizing and taking action, trying to, you know, get better living conditions for them and their families. And it is like a life or death struggle, you know. I think a lot of folks kind of think it like that's not what we're facing or what we're dealing with here. But, I mean, you just recount all these experiences in your family's history and on the public record. And, I mean, it is a life and death struggle.
Yeah, and you know, when you unionize, and that's what people hate to hear around here, because they don't want to see a union come in, because then the bosses know that, they're stuck. They have to pay what they want.
We haven't tried to unionize at our store. We have exercised our labor rights like your dad did, going on strike without a union. That a lot of folks don't know you can do that, but you legally can do that as long as you're a private sector worker. I mean, there are some exceptions, but... generally, yeah, if you're a private sector worker, you have the right to strike without a union, and it can be a successful thing. I mean, sometimes it can be, I guess, a really scary thing, a dangerous thing, you know. But in the instance in which we did, it was to hold our manager accountable. We'd been sexually harassing women workers there at that store, and you know, it worked, thankfully, in that instance. And I mean, a lot of it is, I think. Folks just don't know what their rights are, and there is a lot of kind of threats over just hanging over people's heads, you know, jeopardizing what little bit of security that they might have, even as bad as the trailer park might be or as bad as the job might be. It's still like something versus, you know, you try to rock the boat a little bit, you could end up capsizing and you lose one of those things. And if you lose one of those things, it's very easy to lose the others.
Yeah, and it happens around here.
Oh, I mean, we've seen it so many times just with the tenant union stuff we've been doing. Folks, you try to help out, they end up getting evicted, and then they have to live out of a hotel room or their car. I know several who've ended up having to basically become homeless living in their cars down in Roanoke City, because that's the only place with the largest facilities for homeless folks in this area,
for shelters and things like that. Yeah,
it's really sad, and I just feel like a lot of folks aren't even aware that this is happening.
Well, there's a lot of people around this area that's homeless, but they, you know, they don't speak of it because that would make the community look bad. Or I'm sorry, it would make the old money look bad.
Well, I think there's a lot of personal shame in it too, you know, like people feel responsible for taking care of themselves, which, you know, yeah, we all need to take care of ourselves, but when things like that happen, I think people just tend to think, well, it's entirely my fault, you know, and there's something wrong with me, and I can't talk to folks about this shortcoming of mine, rather than I'm not saying people aren't responsible for their actions, but the reality is we have a limited set of options that we have access to, largely based on the amount of resources we have access to, based on, you know, who, what family we're born into and how much money they have and what's the state of the economy and what social capital our families might have to connect us into a good job or not, or have the opportunity to go get higher education or something like that. Like, none of those things are really considered in when folks end up struggling, getting behind on their rent, and end up evicted, you know? And I just wish folks would recognize more that it's, like, the jobs around here, like you're saying, they're not, like, good-paying jobs, and they're not, they don't really provide the stability that the jobs here used to when there was more manufacturing. So, you know, yeah, evictions are going to be more common because folks just don't have as much money. And like you're saying, the cost of living go up. So we're not getting, our wages aren't increasing with the cost of living, you know?
And then, but they want to increase their things every year.
Well, I don't know how you feel about the whole raising the minimum wage thing, but, you know, you'll hear that argument a lot from folks that, well, if you raise the wage, it's going to raise the prices of everything. Well, the prices of everything have already been going up, you know? And the CEOs of those companies we work for, their bonuses have been going up and their profits have been going up. They're doing all right. So, like, why is it wrong for workers to demand more so they can just live a decent life, you know? And I just don't believe that economic argument they put out there that raising the wages are going to cause a rise in the costs, when it's like, well, they've already risen. And our wages have been stagnant the whole time that they've been raising.
And the thing of it is when TV manufacturers down to people that pump out a gallon of milk, when they know their wage is going up, they increase their prices. You know, if the government was fair, and I mean, they would still make a profit, is freeze prices. Just, okay, if a gallon of milk is $2.39 today, 6 months from now, when minimum wage goes up, it's still $2.39 a gallon, not $3.39 a gallon.
Yeah.
Because somebody's making an extra 50 cents on the hour.
Mm-hmm. And so much of that stuff's already subsidized by the government, too. You know, so many various industries, you know, they have their lobby groups there, and they get the government subsidies to subsidize, you know,
the oil industry,
corn, milk, like you're saying, you know, I'm not hating on it. Just, you know, it's like, well, if we can subsidize and support those folks, then, you know, they're providing a necessary service. I think we all recognize. Yeah, do other workers not provide a necessary service? I definitely don't think we necessarily recognize that a lot of workers provide necessary services. You know, you were saying, like, a lot of folks in the service sector get disrespected routinely. I've experienced that. I've been in the service sector most of my adult life. Yeah, it's just, you know, that argument, you know, oh, it's not a real job. You know, you hear that a lot of times, especially pushing them back against raising minimum wage. You're saying, oh, McDonald's workers, they don't deserve to get 15 an hour. Well, if the costs of living have been going up the whole time and your wages haven't, well, you need your wages to match the cost of living.
And that's the whole thing about this country. And from back during the Great Depression until now, everything goes up, but pay doesn't get up there where it's supposed to be.
Yeah, and productivity has also increased over that same period of time too, which is, you know, a lot of economists would say that as productivity increases, wages should increase with that productivity, but that hasn't happened.
Nope.
The productivity has been, you know, American workers are some of the hardest workers in the world. We have some of the least benefits to show for it. You know, we work longer than a lot of our other first world counterparts. We don't have the same benefits or securities like they do. We don't have guaranteed healthcare or education, higher education. And I mean, it shows. Like, you look at the population of homeless folks increasing, and I mean, so many folks, there, one study was like 50% of Americans don't have an extra $500 emergency dollar sitting in their account. You know, people are living paycheck to paycheck and trying to make ends meet, you know.
I don't think I've ever had an extra $500 in my pocket just to have. I mean, the bills come first, then you've got, you know, the necessities of your food, and you got to have clothes, a lot of things you do for entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, I think entertainment's a necessary thing. You know, a lot of times folks say, well, you know, if you just didn't go to that Starbucks and get that Frappuccino, or if you didn't go out for a beer with your friend that night, you know, maybe then you would be able to buy a home or something.
I can't remember the last time I went out and had a beer. Because it's been so tight.
What are your biggest expenses right now, if you don't mind me asking?
Lot rent's pretty steep. And then, you know, lights and water, they average out about the same every month. You know, it's the little things like you're sitting at the house and then all of a sudden your hot water's not working. And you're like, uh-oh. Well, there's an expense you're not ready for, but you've got to fix it because you've got to have it. So you take money from Peter, which would be maybe some of your grocery money, and fix Paul. And we've had to do that the last few months. Certain things have broke on us. Water heater went out the first of the month, and there was $75 to get it fixed. I did it myself, and I'm able to do things like that. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I can get a plumber to come do it, and it be so bad. Okay? Well, call a couple of plumbing services up around here. Well, it's $75 for us to come out and look at. Finally figured out what it was, and I called the other plumber up. Oh, I can't come out for no less than $125 to take that that heating element out. Yeah. $125 to come out to somebody's home that's already drained the water heater for you, got the power off. All you got to do is come in there and take your tools and pop an element out. $125. Okay, well, yeah. So another plumber called me back and said he couldn't talk, you know, couldn't get over till the next week. And I said, well, I can't get the thermostat, the element out. And he's like, well, get you an impact driver and this size socket and you can take it out. And sure enough, I did. And it cost me $13 to rent the impact driver and the socket and did it myself. And I can't understand why that plumber wanted $125 to come out and take a bolt out.
Yeah, it's crazy expensive being a homeowner. I think a lot of folks maybe aren't even aware that the arrangement of a renting a lot and then owning the trailer that you live at, I think a lot of folks are just kind of used to thinking like, well, if you're a renter, you know, you just rent the unit and the landlord is responsible for all these things.
When they decide to show up and do something for people, a lot of times they, you know, they'll put it off and put it off and put it off.
Yeah.
And I've seen that from a lot of different landlords and different places that I've rented at.
All over this area.
Yeah. You know, our refrigerator went out. Well, go get one. Well, I'm not buying you a new refrigerator. You said appliances were included, and then they look at you. Well, you go buy the refrigerator. Mm. Well, if I buy the refrigerator, it's not staying with you. And then the next thing you know, you're loading your refrigerator up when you move out of a place. Well, that's ours. Huh. No, it's not. I paid for it.
If you were to stop paying lot rent where your trailer's on right now, a lot of folks end up just losing the trailer that they own because of what they owe for the lot rent. And it, so it just seems to me like, well, do you even really own your trailer? Because, I mean, you hypothetically could hire a moving company to pull your trailer out, but that costs thousands of dollars, right? I mean, the folks who are living in these parks don't have thousands of dollars to sit around and pull their trailer. And you got to have a piece of property to move it to. And
it's
got to
have, you know, its own water and sewer. And you've got to have electric put to it. And, you know, the trailer park owners around here have got whoever lives there locked up. You know, if you get a couple of months behind on your lot rent and you try to explain to them and they say, well, okay, well, we'll work with you. Well, they say they're going to work with you, and then 3 days later you get a thing that you've got to go to court because you haven't paid your lot rent. Well, you just told me he's going to work with me. You're not working with me. You want my home so you can go in, paint it, and sell it to somebody else, and then do them the same way six months later.
Yeah. My experience going to do a court watch with tenants over these issues is to see a judge try to sort it out. I mean, it seems like 9 times out of 10, they always rule in favor of the landlord. They don't really ever consider or even give space to hear tenants and their issues. Like, if a tenant tries to complain about the quality of the unit and the issue is that they're behind on their rent, well, you know, the judge they don't care. They're not going to listen to that. They're going to say, well, you should have done a tenant's assertion or rent escrow. Well, that means people who are behind in their rent have to catch up in their rent and then pay the next month's rent into the court. And I mean, that could easily be $1,000, you know? And again, like, folks don't have it. If they had that money sitting around, they wouldn't be behind in the rent in the first place, you know? So it's like, again, the law is just really kind of stacked against folks to have their day in court, you know? And you only have justice if you got some money, it seems like.
Yeah, and able to afford a good attorney that can do a little fighting for you, but.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know if you have any last thoughts or words.
Just everybody have a good holiday.
Great. All right, Nathan, just want to thank you again for doing this interview with us, and you know, we'll be in touch, and maybe we'll do another update with where things are going for you.
Alrighty.